Have you ever wondered what you would get if you crossed a school teacher with a vampire hunter? You would get a character that almost always has a plan, rarely curses, but is willing to rip your heart out. The fantasy novel Blood Magic by R.L. Collins is on Amazon and Barnes & Noble. Welcome to Blood Magic, the podcast. Selena Anderson is a small-town teacher with a big-time problem with vampires who are out to kill her before she can make them her next meal. She is looking forward to a quiet, lazy summer in Culpeper, Virginia. At least this is her plan, until three strangers enter her life in one day. Welcome to episode 22. Vampires and unsavory humans continue their plot against the world. The mad scientists and the vampires were kidnapping humans to use in their experiments. Something had to be done. I left the experimentation chamber and left the office bay. Out on the factory floor, I walked to the back of the plant. I navigated my way around barrels and crates of unknown contents. The back of the plant was bordered by a river. There was a river barge docked at the river entrance with a gangplank leading into the plant. Vampires were unloading large barrels from the cargo hold and bringing them into the factory. I waited for a break in the activity, then I snuck my way up to the platform into the barge. The cargo hold was full of more of those mysterious barrels. There was a ladder at the far end of the cargo hold. I wielded my way down an aisle to climb the ladder onto the deck of the barge. I moved quickly before I could be blocked by someone else coming up or down. On the deck, I could look deep out over the river. It was strangely quiet. Sailors and workers were not milling about on the upper levels. I decided to explore. I walked towards the front of the river barge and came to the captain's cabin. I looked through the glass window in the door and saw that it was empty. I tried the door and it was unlocked. I slipped inside. I looked over the console and computer screens, wishing I could find a way to determine the ship's destination or where it departed from. I just didn't know enough about the system to get those answers. While I stood there perplexed, the captain and a sailor came in. I flattened myself against the back wall. "When are we due back, Captain?" the young sailor asked. "Tomorrow at midnight. We will ship the goods here every night for the next 2 weeks," the captain replied. "We can only ship at midnight?" "I don't know. It's their special orders. Believe me, they are paying us very well to follow these special orders," the captain said as he began throwing controls and flipping switches. It looked like he was preparing to leave the factory. Worried that I was going to be trapped as a stowaway, I left out the door and down the deck. I practically ran my way back the way I had come. In no time, I had made my way down the ladder and across the cargo hold on the gangplank. I turned to look back at the river barge one last time before I re-entered the plant to see that the vessel's name was LaFleur. Back in the warehouse, I stalked along the opposite wall. Here, the vampires were busy worker bees. They pried open the barrels with crowbars. I stood beside one particularly harried vampire as he lifted the lid from a barrel. I stuck my neck out to get a good look inside. I was surprised to see plants. The plants were green with red spots. After lifting the lid, the vampire slid the container onto a device that lifted the barrel and dumped its contents into a large vat. Shortly after that, the vampire began the same process on another barrel. Someone called to him and he turned away from his job. I took the opportunity to grab a handful of plants and shove them into my pocket. It disappeared into my pocket as if wearing a cloak of invisibility. With my sample of stolen goods, my curiosity turned to the assembly line laid out before me. The first thing I decided to investigate was that vat. There was a narrow ladder that stretched up the side of the vat next to the lift device. I carefully climbed the ladder and realized it was a great vantage point. From the perch, I could look out over the manufacturing portion of the factory. The plants were dumped into the vat, where they were pulverized into juice. The juice was filtered into another container where it was boiled and stirred. It looked like a giant mixing bowl. After the juice was boiled, it passed through another container where other ingredients were added. Colorful powders and liquids were added until the mixture was a thick white honey-like substance. The next step was to send the mixture through a coolant process where it came out of a conveyor belt as solid white bricks. In this form, it was ready to be ground into powder and distributed into whatever drug the monsters chose. From atop the ladder, I began to feel a little strange. I felt nauseous and a heaviness in my gut. I held out my hand to see myself become visible for a few seconds, then change back to being transparent. The spell was wearing off. Alarmed, I climbed down the ladder and began to run along the side of the assembly line, dodging equipment, barrels, and vampires. I stubbed my toe on a crate and failed to stifle a gasp. This attracted attention of a vampire who looked in my direction, then changed his course to come and investigate. I hugged the wall and tried to slide even closer to the exit. When I was a few yards away, I looked behind me. The vampire was handling the crate I bumped into. He turned it around and around and sniffed the air. At the main door, I could hardly wait for someone to open it, so I finally left. My heart was pounding in my chest, and I tried to breathe shallowly to avoid being heard. Finally, I was in luck. It was time for the guards to change. Two tall and thick vampires came from Marvin's office and opened the exit doors. They stood outside talking to the previous guards for a few minutes. I took the opportunity to slip out the door. I sidled around them, giving them a wide berth before racing down the access road. I stuck to the shadows and looked down to see myself flicker visible, then invisible. At the end of the road, I turned the corner that would take me back to the van. I flickered one more time, then I was visible. For good. I was casting shadows. I was covered in dust from my excursion. Bob saw me and opened the door for me. I launched myself inside and we sped off into the night. On the ride back to Bob's, I went over everything I saw in the factory, the office, the lab, the ship, the manufacturing line. I brought the plant samples out of my pocket. With more time to inspect them, we realized that the plant looked like a giant four-leaf clover. One clover was the width of my hand. The red spots, however, made it a mystery. I passed the plant around to the other team members, but no one recognized it. Bob spared a glance at it from his driver's seat. He shared that he had a friend at Roanoke University that worked in the biology department. That friend owed him a favor. Bob would call him in the morning to see if he could look at our findings. "What about this Marvin's computer?" Devlin said. "He had a database of humans tied to the drug network," I said. "Did you get any names?" John asked. "I remember a few. I think we should go back with the flash drive and download as much as possible," I thought out loud. "Yes, we can turn this network of humans into the police," Catherine chimed in. "I don't think they would be able to do this without the human help," Tina said from the front of the van. "We also need to clear those humans out of their cages. They were treating them like lab rats," I said. "We also need to find out where they are growing this plant." Devlin turned it around in the dim lighting. "Perhaps we need to blow everything up. Factory and the farms where the plant is grown." "That sounds like an awesome idea," Sinju said, grinning fiercely. "What was the barge called?" Tina asked. "La Fleur. Ships that size can't sail the waters anonymously. If we could figure out where it departs, that would also give us a clue to the plant's location," she said. "It's going to dock there every night at midnight for the next 2 weeks." "That is a lot to strategize," Devlin said. "It's been a long night. I think we should all get some rest." At Bob's, we all dispersed and settled down for the night. I washed my face and braided my hair. I laid my head down on my pillow and slept like the dead. Around noon, Bob, Tina, Devlin, and I were walking across the open campus of Roanoke University. The day was clear and sunny. Summer students milled around on the lawn reading or eating their lunches. The science building, like the rest of the campus, was beautifully styled after early Greek architecture. We walked up the wide and sloping stairs to the first floor that housed the biology department. We found Bob's friend, Dr. Rob Kent, in the science lab. He was measuring solutions in test tubes and setting up multiple lab stations for his next class. Dr. Kent was in his mid-50s with salt and pepper hair. He greeted us with an easy smile as he peered at us from behind tortoiseshell glasses. Bob made introductions. "Please call me Rob," he said, "and let's see this mysterious plant that you found." "I've got it right here," I said, as I pulled out the sandwich bag containing a sample. Rob gently took it from my hand and held it up to the light. "At first glance, this looks like a variety of clover. The size and number of leaflets makes you think it's a hybrid, a cross between a clover and a rose. Mind if I take a look at a sample under the microscope?" he asked. "Sure, go ahead," I said. Rob opened the bag and walked to the microscope at the front of the lab. He cut off a piece of the plant and placed it on a slide with a drop of water and cover slip. Then he placed it under the eye and began to look at it while adjusting the knobs. Rob made a few appreciative sounds as he stared at the plant. I believe this plant has been genetically altered, he said. I'm going to need to run some more tests. Can I get back to you with my findings? I might be able to call you back later on today. That would be fine, Bob said. Any help you can give would be much appreciated. We made our way out of the science lab and back out into the beautiful sunny day. At Bob's, the team gathered around the couch in the living room and we were deep in discussion. I paced back and forth behind the couch. How are the vampires able to easily pull these humans and nobody misses them? I thought out loud on one of my trips across the carpet. Gerald sat on the couch at the laptop. He was quietly punching away the keys and he said, "Actually, I think they are missed. The problem is that nobody is connecting the dots to see the bigger picture. Come look at this." I paused behind him and looked over his shoulder at the computer screen. These are reports of missing people. There's been a spike of occurrences in this area in the last 2 weeks. He scrolled through a few of the photos. "Wait, this one looks familiar," I said. It was a happy photo of a pretty brunette with blue eyes. "She looks a lot healthier here, but she looks like the emaciated woman I saw at the factory. The monsters were feeding her drugged donuts. What does it say about her?" Gerald read her profile. "Nancy Knott, age 28, missing from King's Dominion 2 weeks ago, originally from Roanoke. Save that file," I said, becoming more interested in the database. Gerald saved the file and continued scrolling through the pictures. I had him stop at a professional photo of an African-American man. He smiled up at us with a navy blue suit and tie on. "He was one of the men being fed the poison smoke. What is his story?" I asked. "This one is Nathan Short, age 34, missing from King's Dominion 1 week ago, originally from Dermot," Gerald read. "Let's save that one too," I said. Completely intrigued, I walked around the couch to sit next to Gerald. The very next picture was a Hispanic man with an easygoing smile. I recognized him right away. "That one. He was the other guy infected by the smoke." Gerald was diligent and read his profile as well. "Rick Lopez, age 44, missing from King's Dominion 5 days ago, originally from Huntington, Virginia." "Huntington isn't that far from here," Bob said as he sipped coffee from a black mug in his lazy boy chair. "Keep going," I told Gerald. We were reviewing photos for a few minutes when another one jumped out at me. "That one," I said, jabbing my finger in the computer screen. It was a picture of a young man with blonde hair styled into a mohawk. "Let's see," Gerald said. "This one is Alex Defoe, age 21 years old. He disappeared from King's Dominion 3 days ago. He's originally from Greene, Virginia." Gerald saved that file. "He was the one willingly snorting the drug. He was acting like he was a pro at it." Devlin leaned forward and rested his elbows on his knees as he sat on the other side of Gerald. "Well, this is definitely a pattern," he said. "So far, they all disappeared from King's Dominion. It's a public place with tons of people always passing through. This is not like the vampires that we know," John said from his armchair. "I would think it would be easy to disappear in a big place like that," Tina said. "Everyone and no one is a suspect. The vampires must have human help," I said. "I wish we had a way of getting more information." Devlin smiled from around Gerald and said, "We can launch our own investigation and talk to the families." "No way. We can't just knock on their doors and expect them to tell us everything we need to know," I said. "Well, not as ourselves, but they might respond to FBI Agent Smith," Devlin said as he pointed at himself. Then he pointed at me, and FBI Agent Johnson. Then John chimed in, and FBI Agent Cooper. "Yes," Devlin continued, "from the FBI's Bureau of Missing Persons." I smiled as I followed their train of thought. Time was short and we needed to put our plan together. Gerald borrowed a digital camera from Bob and took photos of Devlin, John, and myself. Then he got to work photoshopping them onto fake FBI badges that Devlin just happened to pack for this Roanoke trip. Devlin also pulled out a black suit, cerulean blue shirt, and matching tie that he packed into his bag. John and I weren't that prepared. We had to make a trip to the local Belk. John came back with a black suit of his own and a canary yellow shirt and matching tie. I settled on navy blue pantsuit with a white blouse. When we got back from our shopping excursion, Gerald had hacked the missing persons database to get the addresses on our locals. Bob allowed us to borrow his black Range Rover to complete our federal look. Our first stop was Nancy Knott at 9321 Langley Lane. Chapter 13. Nancy Knott's home was a blue and white Rambler on the outskirts of town. Devlin parked the Range Rover on the street and we got out and gathered on the porch. I adjusted my blouse and suit jacket. I was a little nervous about whether or not we could pull this off. I had never tried to impersonate someone outside of Halloween. Devlin knocked on the door and we waited. A middle-aged woman with brown hair and blue eyes opened the door, dressed in a cream and orange maxi dress. Devlin held up his FBI badge, and John and I followed suit. Then he said, "Hi, ma'am. My name is Agent Smith. This is Agent Johnson and Agent Cooper. We're here from the Bureau of Missing Persons to investigate the disappearance of Nancy Knott." The woman threw the door open and clasped her hands together. "Thank goodness you are here. I'm Maxine Knott, Nancy's mother. I'd almost given up hope that the police would keep looking for her. Do come in." Maxine led us through a short foyer into the sunny living room. A large bay window illuminated the cozy living room. Family pictures covered almost every surface. There were photos of Nancy with her mother, who must have been her father. I could also see pictures of a small boy. Many of them were the boy and Nancy together. We sat on the couch, and Mrs. Knott caught my eye looking at a family photo at the end of the table. "That's Nancy and her boy Tim. He's 6 years old. Her father and I have been living here with them. We didn't want to make too many drastic changes by moving him to a new school. Oh dear, I've been rude. Let me get some tea and then we could talk about Nancy." Thank you for listening. Come back, same time, same place, to hear the tale of the kidnappings at King's Dominion.